you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Someone is trying to teach me a lesson in futility. Why am I the only one who isn't killed?
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
I just want to say one word to you. Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, sir, you.
Plastics.
I'm going to get your money for you. But if you don't get the President of the United States on that phone, you know what's going to happen to you?
What?
You're going to have to answer to the Coca-Cola company.
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale. It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It's my pleasure to have Mark Devlin back on the show. Mark is a UK-based club and radio DJ and a music journalist specializing in black and dance music in its many forms. He hosts the Good Vibrations podcast. He's also an author. Of course, he authored Musical Truth, published a couple of years ago. He has recently, or earlier this year, published Musical Truth 2, which sort of continues as a continuation of his research in the music industry and entertainment industry in general. Basically, he writes about how the corporate music industry, it's not just about all fun and games. It's about cybernetics, control, manipulation of culture and such. So, Mark, how are you doing?
Yeah, Tim, what's going on? Good to be back with you, brother.
Thanks. So, Musical Truth 2, let's talk about your latest book and we'll get into the conversation.
Okay, so as you just mentioned, Musical Truth 1 was published in 2016, and that brought together 5 years' worth of research into the true nature of the corporate music industry and all the various shenanigans that go on behind the scenes. And I really did put my heart and soul into that book. It took quite a long time to write, and I reflected that if I never put another piece of work into the world, that would stand as my magnum opus, you know, that would be my contribution to humanity. But happily, I got to write a second volume of it, which was published earlier this year, Musical Truth Volume 2, and it was building on the same themes, just with more information and more validation of what I put out in that first book. And it can all be summed up by stating that the corporate music industry is not there to entertain you. It's not all about fun and letting your hair down and having a good time, which we're led to believe. It's actually all about control. It's mind control. It's dictating your thoughts, emotions, perceptions, value systems. It's all done very covertly under the radar. It's all done under the guise of entertainment so that people's guard is down. Nobody's expecting to be mind controlled when they just want to listen to a favorite piece of music or go and check out a favorite band or go to a club or whatever. So all the tales that have gone into the second volume just reinforce that viewpoint, really. Many different facets to it. Many names come up in the conversation. I discuss many tactics and methods that are used. But the story is all the same, that the entertainment industry is not what we thought it was. And in fact, the corporate music industry turns out to have basically been a military-grade operation all along. And what I've noticed, and there are endless examples of this, is that the sons and daughters of military personnel instead of being put into the forces on the front line, are so often trained up as musicians and actors, and they're put into that field to serve their duty instead. So it's another way of them serving the system and being an asset to the establishment, but not in the way that people think of. And I think it was decided a long time ago that it was far easier to control entire populations of people by way of covert mind control and what would be referred to as behavioral modification, their term, not mine, than by open-faced, boots-on-the-ground tyranny that can be seen and understood and reacted to. And what comes to mind when I state that are some comments by a guy by the name of Yuri Bezmenov, who was a KGB agent, and he became something of a whistleblower or an insider, came forward a few years ago talking about some of the tactics that had been used covertly by the KGB during the Cold War years to control populations and throw their political enemies off track and, you know, away from the target. And one of the tactics that he discussed was the creation of false heroes and role models. So, you know, it's a military grade operation to create gurus, celebrities, leaders that people look up to and place on pedestals and give all their attention and disempower themselves to. And all the while, these people are not who you thought they were. You think they've got there through their own merits, their own skill, through working really hard, by pure random chance. But in actual fact, they've been placed there as a military type tactic in order to divert your attention off towards them and away from other things that you might otherwise be directing it to. This was a real eye-opener for me when I first came to this understanding, but I think the whole dynamic can be summed up by stating that the music industry is nothing more than a military-grade operation.
Yeah, it's difficult for people to wrap their head around that, because the, you know, nothing can, at least on a superficial level, can be more separated than, say, you know, the culture of Hollywood than maybe the culture of the Pentagon or CIA in these things. But as you, right, you look beneath the surface, anyone who's done even a cursory examination of these things, that the connections are deep, and it's pretty obvious that the powers that be wouldn't want something as, you know, as influential as entertainment, whether it's be the movies, television, or music. Music is very influential to, you know, to just let it develop on its own. You've mentioned Yuri Bezmenov, and, you know, a lot of people have listened to, you know, his interviews, what it said, and of course that's done. He spoke that sort of in a Cold War context. But the important point here is that we're talking about, you know, the forces of cultural Marxism, and really the powers that be imported the cultural Marxists into the United States in the 20th century. They fanned out, went into Hollywood and broadcasting, and most importantly, the universities at a key moment here in the United States when the university system was expanding rapidly in the post-war era to meet the demand for the baby boomers in the 60s. And we saw how, you know, it's bitter fruit in the 60s with the cultural revolution of that time. But the important point is this was a domestic operation. It wasn't the Soviet evil communists doing it to us.
Right.
In the final analysis, the whole thing we call the Cold War and communism itself was itself a product of New York and London.
Right. Social engineering operation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it really strikes me that military institutions view their personnel as owned assets or commodities. And it seems that the offspring of high-ranking military personnel are treated as rife for usage wherever their controllers see fit. So as I mentioned, rather than always deploying them on the ground in an obvious expression of the military like the Army or the Marines or the Air Force or the Navy, I think so often these sons and daughters are pushed into the world of popular culture to be assets there. And it's long become clear that organizations like the CIA and MI5 and MI6, which we think of as intelligence operations that are on the side of the people, they're basically there to keep us safe and protect us and represent our best interests. You see this through things like the James Bond films. They create this idea that somebody like James Bond, a British intelligence agent, is there to keep the world safe and to fight all these dastardly villains that are out to harm us. But the truth of the matter, in this crazy, upside-down, satanically inverted world in which we live, is that these very agencies are actually doing the harm to us. That's what they're there for. So these sons and daughters that are pushed into popular culture roles, whether they are coerced into becoming musicians or Hollywood actors or television presenters or whatever else it is, they're really no freer than their hardcore military counterparts. You know, you sign up for a career in the army and your ass is owned. But you get pushed into a career in the music industry if you come from one of these important families, and your ass is equally as owned, I would suggest. Military personnel are often used for experimentation, you know, when they want to test out things like microchipping and brain implants and stuff. They tend to use military guys and girls to test these things out because, again, it comes down to the way they're viewed. They're owned commodities, they're possessions. And I think it's no different with the entertainment business. Yes, it is about making shitloads of money for the oligarchical overlords to a certain extent. They do love to make a profit. But I think the primary purpose of these organizations is control. It's creating societal conditions and psychological mindsets within the masses to ensure that the elite ruling class can continue to maintain their position. That's what these popular culture institutions are used for, and they want tried and trusted personnel to be at the helm of these things. They want their Pied Pipers and their leaders to be under their control, so they don't go off on their own agendas, they don't express themselves individually, they continue to toe the establishment line. So I think that's what's going on. And as another example of upside down inversion in this insane world in which we find ourselves, isn't it interesting that so many regular people dream of being just like their favorite celebs? So they aspire to be rich and famous and successful as they see it. They want to live these fantastic, glamorous lives as they see them. And they long to be a famous, successful rock star or a famous, successful Hollywood actor. And the truth of the matter is that so many of these celebrities that are either born into that life by way of the family or the bloodline that they come from, or they're coerced and manipulated into it, must surely dream of being free and living a regular, ordinary life. So you got these famous rich celebrities looking at the likes of you and I and most people listening to this and thinking, I wish I could just go back to an ordinary life. What I would give to be a grocery checkout clerk, what I would give to be a bus driver, what I would give to be, a teller in a bank or a guy that collects the trolleys at the local supermarket, something like that. It turns out you're actually better off where you are in what you perceive to be a boring, humdrum existence than where you so desperately want to be when you look up to these celebrities and aspire to be just them. You know, I've discovered that the hard way. I used to look up to successful radio and club DJs and think, why am I not where they are? I want to be on that level. And again, how many people listening to this have looked at various other celebrities and thought, why can't I be like them? Well, the truth of the matter is, when you do the research and when you're prepared to accept the truth of the matter, you really are better off where you are. And so many of these celebrities are probably envying the likes of us and wishing they could live our lives. How's that for crazy satanic inversion in this reality?
yeah, it's I mean, obviously, if you're going through the store and you see the celebrity rags, and there's always a divorce here or some sort of tumult here being told in the household of some celebrity, the impression you get is they're not happy people. They're just
right,
I guess, from all accounts, want for nothing that money can buy, but they're not happy. And, you know, that's sort of lifestyle, of course, promoted, because that also spreads scandal in society. It's a way of spreading degenerate behavior throughout the culture in general. As you promote celebrity lifestyles, everyone reads about it, sort of normalizes it. Something like, a figure like Elizabeth Taylor, went a long way in legitimizing divorce in American culture, where there are many right. marriages, and that's sort of a function. And that kind of goes back as the early days when the whole celebrity culture was created. Of course, technology plays a big part in this. It was, the creation of film, particularly the talkies, the film with sound, and the establishment of a movie theater in every small town in America. And all of a sudden, you had, of course, the publication industry with celebrity magazines and these things. Now, for the first time, people were seeing these celebrities on this large screen, and they're always better looking, and they're living more adventurous, exciting lives than you, and working on a farm or something. And for the first time, the people, had the idea of celebrity. This, and I guess this was Edward Bernays developed this in the early part of the 20th century, and I believe his objective was to create sort of a new pantheon of the gods for the very purpose of what you say, was manipulate the culture, turn it into sort of a consumer-based, debt-based society, following their leaders, following demigods, and in its own way, create a certain level of chronic unhappiness. And how you feed that is through addiction, whether it's through consumer goods or drugs, and you look at how that feeds this sort of system that we're dealing with.
Right. As you say, so many celebrities seem unhappy when you strip away the glossy, glamorous surface. They seem depressed. Half of them are on fucking Prozac, anti-depression medication. Many of them are alcoholic. Many of them just exhibit degenerate, debased behavior because they don't know how to live moral lives. And really, is that any way to live? Is that anything to aspire to? Why would anyone want to live that kind of daily existence? It's a very different world once the cameras are turned off. And once these individuals walk off that stage, we don't see that. We just see the glossy public relations version of these people and their personas. So I'm pretty sure that those who are selected for this type of service to the establishment undergo their own version of military boot camp. And this would be in the form of lifetime actor training schools. So I'm sure a lot of them are these foundations and academies that you get for the performing arts. A lot of these places have to function as a version of military boot camp, where these chosen ones go and get trained up to be very skilled and accomplished and polished musicians or actors or whatever other kind of performers they're going to be. Because you see so many of these people emerging all of a sudden as fully formed rock stars. They're all ready to go. They've got their skill and their talent and their public image all in place. Look at how young the Beatles and the Rolling Stones were when they first emerged on the scene. You know, they arrived as these fully formed groups, all ready to take the public by storm and become ultra successful very, very quick. The Beatles were, you know, between the ages of 18 and 20 when they first broke through with Love Me Do in the UK in late 1962, and then early 64 when they burst onto the American scene as a result of their Ed Sullivan Show appearance. Very, very young guys. The Rolling Stones also very early 20s when they first emerged. Mick Jagger came out of the London School of Economics, you know, as all rock stars do. Why else would you study there? And I really do wonder about these lifetime actor training schools and where they all are and what the public front is for many of them. I'm convinced the Brit School in Croydon is one of these, you know. Just south of London, in the town of Croydon, you've got this institution known as the Brit School. And so many prominent British musicians who've gone on to become very commercially successful have trained at this place. I think from memory, Lily Allen was trained up there, Amy Winehouse, James Blunt, Kate Nash. There's going to be many, many others I've forgotten, but people can look up the Brit School in Croydon and see some of the names that have emerged out of this place. And there have got to be many other institutions similar to this. And, you know, a good question, I think, would be, why do the offspring of important historical bloodlines and aristocratic families, as well as military families and those steeped in organizations like the CIA and British intelligence, things like that, why do they end up as rock stars, musicians, or some other kind of entertainers? Because we see so many examples of this. One thing that came across my radar in the last week was I was reminded of the situation with Marianne Faithfull. So she was kind of a groupie, for want of a better phrase, with the Rolling Stones. She hung out with that group, and she was the one-time lover of Brian Jones, the founder of the Rolling Stones. Then she seemed to go over to Mick Jagger and become his partner. And I think she had a thing going with Keith Richards as well. So basically a groupie, you know, hung out with the band, took shitloads of drugs, hung out in these commune-type living situations that that band was involved with, and just lived this very degenerate, debased rock star kind of lifestyle. But you look at her background, and her father, surprise, surprise, would you believe it, sit down so you don't fall over in shock, was a career military man. But also, she emanates from an aristocratic bloodline, which goes all the way back to the Massok family coming out of Austria. And it's from that family that we get the term masochist, as in sadomasochist. They had ties to the Marquis de Sade. So that's the family that Marianne Faithfull came out of. You might imagine she'd live rather more a dignified existence than hanging around in squalid communes doing drugs with stoned out rock stars. But that's how she ended up. You know, how else do you explain situations like that other than these are people fulfilling roles that have been set out for them by way of their backgrounds, their families, because they're all serving the establishment, and these roles that they're given are part of agendas to change culture and to change societal attitudes. Marianne Faithfull is just one of so many examples we can give of that type of dynamic.
Yeah, another name that comes up is Patty Boyd.
Right.
Yeah, with Eric Clapton and George Harrison, and of course she's supposedly the inspiration for the song Layla. So yeah, you have these, and again, it's not so much how they're living; it's just how their lifestyles are then splashed on the front pages of, you know, of newspapers, and it's promoted in the music and these things, and this is promoting a certain lifestyle. The sort of elite deviancy that we see among these aristocratic families is somewhat well known. I'm reminded of the, if you recall, I did an interview a while back regarding the Beatles and sort of the Profumo affair and
with Matt Sergio,
and how that involved certain, you know, he talks about the movie, I think it's The Bank Job, and that involves the supposed photographs. There's a Princess Margaret engaging in the British Princess Margaret engaging in photographs of her engaging in behavior, and it was sort of a way to get a hold of these photographs and these things. But the whole idea of promoting the scandal itself, the Profumo affair, was a way of ushering in a new era into London, which was then, up until the 60s, was sort of a conservative, staid, you know, environment. Then that created the era of swinging London. And it coincided with sort of the Cultural Revolution that the Beatles were helping ushering in, but it's also the function of these sex scandals and just getting the front pages and these things. And it helped sort of usher in, of course, the new government under, I guess there was Harold Wilson, and the fall of the Macmillan government the year before. But it's sort of a cultural shift. And, you know, Harold Wilson, you know, would take photographs with the Beatles and these things, and one really, he was more hip. And I think you referenced in your book sort of and even he, Matt Sergio, mentioned sort of this sort of repeated again with Tony Blair, you know, in Cool Britannia, and Tony Blair versus John Major. Yeah. Tony Blair could be seen with rock stars, and it could be, rumored that he smoked pot too, and these things. This is all part of, again,
like Bill Clinton, right?
Yeah. Like Bill Clinton playing the saxophone. Then also Bill Clinton had his own scandal, right? Many. And how that, you know, changed
just
how
a couple.
Yeah, it changed public discourse about how we talk about these things, and it sort of normalizes these things. It's sort of a social alchemy that's occurring when these things are supposedly revealed.
Right. So. That was a great interview you did with Matt Sergio, and I'd certainly encourage people to go back and listen to that. You know, he's a really skilled researcher. He's got his site, The Occult Beatles. which he's putting most of his energy into at the moment. He was also behind the Conspiro Media site. And yeah, he's put out some really good information. I've cited him a few times in my books. He specializes in looking at the 60s counterculture from a London point of view. So most attention goes towards California in those times. But Matt's shown that there was a whole scene happening in Britain. And there's just links going off all over the place. There's connections going into military intelligence, once again. There's connections going into the world of aristocracy, expressions of the government. There's mind control. There's drugs. There's pedophilia. And usually when you find one of these elements, the others aren't far from the surface. That's something I've noticed, unfortunately. Whenever you get into military intelligence and the activities of the CIA and MI5, MI6 and the Tavistock Institute, you often find connections into pedophilia, unfortunately, institutionalized child sexual abuse and satanic ritual abuse. You also find connections going into trauma-based mind control, and you find all these connections going back into the establishment and these different families that I mentioned. Connections for days. And what's really encouraging for me now, Tim, is to see so many people doing this style of research and applying a different level of scrutiny to who their manufactured heroes really are and the real reasons why they've been served up to us. Obviously, a lot more of it needs to happen because hero worship is still very, very strong, and everyone, it seems, has their own personal guru that they place up on a pedestal. We've all been guilty of it. I certainly have. It's difficult to let these people go. But I think slowly and begrudgingly, many people are coming to a realization of how this dynamic works and the fact that celebrities and popular household names that you've heard of are served up to us rather than having worked really hard to have got to that position under their own steam. And this is borne out by the amount of tips and pointers and little tidbits of information that I now get in daily correspondence from readers and listeners to my work. So the first couple of hours of every day now, I have to spend going through emails that have come in overnight from people responding to aspects of my work. And I don't say that to blow my own trumpet or make myself sound really great. I'm just saying it as a way of expressing how this snowball type effect is happening, where people can take something that a researcher has put out and it can inspire them to do their own research, do a bit of digging off their own backs, and they come up with some information that other people may have missed, and they offer that in the spirit of cooperation, and all this information gets pulled together and we can start to see patterns forming and we can start to see connections which you might not otherwise have seen. So it's really satisfying to see this process taking place. And as I say, people bring stuff to my doorstep every single day now and say, have you come across this? And you mentioned this about such and such. Well, did you know this aspect of their backstory? And did you know that they're connected to this particular institution? And it's all starting to come together now. And it's a really great thing. It's incredible that so much of this information has laid dormant for decades, literally decades. Thinking about the work that Matt is doing that we just mentioned, or the 1960s scene. Here we are 50 odd years later, finally piecing together bits of information and forming connections and forming patterns that nobody has done for the past 40 or 50 years. Look at how much research is now going into Paul McCartney and who he may really be and who he certainly isn't, and the true nature of the Beatles and why they were created 50 years after the event. It's amazing that people are doing this, but we're able to because this is an era of information sharing almost exclusively as a result of the internet and people being able to communicate in ways that they previously weren't. So it really is a great thing. And I thought we could maybe look at some examples of scenarios that have been raised by people that have got in touch with me in recent weeks and some of the stuff they've raised, because it's all stuff that was missed by me, but they tell me it was my work that inspired them to dig this stuff up, and now they've brought it across my radar, and it's eye-opening for me to see. So maybe we could look some examples of that if you're happy to do so.
Oh yeah, certainly. We're getting that, and this whole idea of sort of this crowdsourcing or open source investigation is the way to go, because you simply can't rely on the official organs or the official biographies of these people. Same way you can't look at the textbooks or the academic historians to rely on what's really happened in history. They tell an interesting story, but it's the reality is far different. So yeah, certainly let's get into it.
Yeah, let's look at some examples. And really, most of this information that people bring to me is already in the public domain. And that's really what this style of research is all about. You can take information that is readily available to anyone. You don't have to go digging in obscure libraries and getting documents through Freedom of Information Acts and things like that, although it's certainly useful to do so. But you can find out so much through looking at newspaper reports and obituaries and official biographies online and aspects of Wikipedia. Of course, Wikipedia is controlled. It is a limited hangout. It is a mouthpiece for the establishment, so we shouldn't place too much stock in everything that it says. But nevertheless, some of the citations that you get from a Wikipedia entry can tell you a lot. And they just present things in a really blasé sort of fashion. So they'll say, oh, here's a famous rock star you've heard of, and his mother worked in the Pentagon, and his father was a high-ranking Navy admiral. But anyway, he formed this band, and he did these songs and stuff, and they just act like it's nothing, that this is who this person's parents were. But a vigilant researcher will look at something like that and go, wait, hang on, his dad was what? So why then did this guy turn out to be a punk musician? Wouldn't you have expected him to do something similar to his father, or to have some kind of different role in society to be in a punk musician? So it's a case of looking at all this information that is readily available and bringing it all together and seeing what it tells you, particularly in tandem with research that's gone before, where we can see how some of these dynamics play out. And one thing I've noticed is every time you think you found a genre which is pure and unsullied, you can say, oh, I know the psychedelic rock scene that came out of the counterculture in the 60s was dirty as hell. There's connections for days going into the CIA and the military and stuff. And the punk and new wave scene, it's pretty obvious that came out of these same expressions of the establishment. But, the drum and bass scene is pure. That evolved organically. Or the acid house scene just came about as a result of four London DJs going to Ibiza and bringing these tunes back and all these records coming out of Chicago. That's pure and clean and unsullied. Well, you come to realize in the end that none of them are clean and unsullied. I've had to come to this very harsh realization with hip-hop culture just recently. Because, what currently passes for hip-hop is obviously completely debased and complete garbage. And it's satanic at its core when you get down to the agendas that it's being used for. But I used to go back to the early days of hip-hop culture, and I considered it to be this beautiful art form that evolved organically out of the streets of the South Bronx in New York, out of the sound system culture that was brought by guys like Kool Herc and Afrika Bambaataa and Grandmaster Flash. And it just went off and swept up all these communities in its wake and became a way for these people to express themselves artistically. And it was a wonderful, pure thing. Well, certain information that's come across my radar recently has caused me to question whether the story is quite that simple and whether any scene evolved that innocently off its own back versus being made to go off in certain desired directions. Or even if it does start out organically and pure, at some point during its development, there seems to be a stage where it was hijacked and subverted and went off in certain desired directions. With the hip-hop thing, it was the revelations about Afrika Bambaataa that came out a couple of years ago, where he was accused by initially two guys who were formerly a part of the Universal Zulu Nation, this collective group of which he was the figurehead. They came out and accused him of sexually molesting them when they were young boys back in the late 70s, early 80s. And then many, many other people have come forward in the wake of those two to say, yes, it's been well known that Bambaataa has been a child molester. So that caused me to question who this guy really is and how it is that he became the flag bearer and the Pied Piper of the whole hip hop culture genre. You know, you've got to ask these questions. So that kind of set me off into looking deeper into that whole thing. And I discovered some things that were very unsettling that I really didn't want to find. But if you're an open-minded, critically thinking truth seeker and you go wherever the information takes you, you have to be prepared to go to some dark and devastating places sometimes. So it's led me to believe that there aren't really any genres which are untouched by these hidden hands of manipulation. And it seems many people agree with me. And this is borne out by all these comments that I get from people that now get in touch. One guy got in touch a few months ago and he said that it's his belief that the social controllers have these different genres and these different scenes ready and waiting. They have the blueprints for them already in place. And they decide when the time is right to unleash them on the general public. So they've got a basic idea of what a music scene is going to consist of, what the basic sound is going to be, what the target demographic is going to be. Is it going to be aimed at primarily black people? Is it going to be aimed at primarily white rockers that are into, you know, certain types of music and eschew certain other types of music? What kind of dress code is it going to have? What sort of fashions are going to go with it? What is the drug of choice going to be? Because it seems each of these music genres has its own chosen drug, whether it's ecstasy or weed or heroin or LSD, whatever it is. And this guy stated that he thinks they've got all these things ready to roll out in these different decades. And I don't think he's wrong. Anyway, maybe we should start with a really interesting one, which was brought to my attention just a few days ago. So I'm going to be quoting some people that have got in touch. I'm not going to give their names because I don't think they'd appreciate it, and it doesn't really matter. The only thing that's important is that these are real people out there that have just got in touch with this stuff. So this one person raised the question of the Smiths, the group The Smiths, that came out of Manchester, an indie group in the mid-80s, very successful, very influential. And they had a song out in 1986 called Panic, which people might be familiar with. It's very synchronistic, this, because a couple of days before this person's email landed in my inbox, I'd been in a bar listening to some music and The Smiths' Panic came on the radio. And I thought, damn, I've not heard this song for years. And it just kind of renewed my interest in it. Then, at the weekend, I was watching a show on BBC Four, which was all about the year 1986, celebrating the music of that era. And they had this little sequence where they showed the video for Panic by The Smiths. So that's twice that song came into my consciousness directly before I received this email. So I think this was supposed to happen. So this person raised a conspiracy theory, for want of a better phrase, which seems to have first emerged in 2012 in the wake of the revelations about Jimmy Savile. So Jimmy Savile, as people may be aware, was a BBC TV and television presenter that was employed by the corporation for several decades, from the 1950s all the way through to a few years before his death. He died in October 2011. In October 2012, almost exactly a year later, revelations came forward to show that Jimmy Savile had in fact been a serial paedophile, almost certainly a necrophiliac, and according to some researchers, although it doesn't seem to have been completely validated, a killer in his own right. But he was certainly a serial child abuser. Many, many victims have come forward in the wake of his death to state that he abused them, and many of them state that it happened on BBC premises in his dressing room. He used to present this show called Top of the Pops for many, many years. He became a household name. He was referred to as a national treasure. That's another good question. Who decides who's going to be a national treasure? Bill Cosby was a national treasure, right, in the States. So who decides on these titles? Who decides Rolf Harris is going to be a national treasure? This is social engineering as well. These phrases are created for us rather than us inventing them. So all these revelations about Savile came out in 2012. On a few chat forums towards the end of 2012, a few people were picking up on lyrics to the Smiths song Panic. And there's this one particular lyric where Morrissey, he name checks a bunch of English towns and also Dundee and Dublin in Scotland and Ireland. And one of the places he references is Leeds. And the lyric goes, the Leeds side streets that you slip down, the provincial towns that you jog around. Now, Jimmy Savile was from Leeds, and he did what on the surface was presented as a lot of great work for charity. This involved him jogging and doing marathons, races at various towns around the UK. Almost certainly, his charity work was a way of getting him close to kids, because he was the patron of various hospitals, including the spinal injury unit of Stoke Mandeville Hospital in Aylesbury, where he would turn up in the wards and visit these kids that were paralysed and bedridden and couldn't move or get out of their beds. And, you know, Jimmy Savile coming into your ward has got to be your worst bloody nightmare when you're in that position, right? Yeah. So a lot of his activities were done under the guise of him being this really nice guy that cared and did a lot of good work for charity. He was close personal friends with the royal family, Prince Charles in particular. He was close personal friends with Margaret Thatcher, the British Prime Minister. He was knighted by the Queen twice. He was close personal friends with the Pope. So, you know, lots of questions arise here. Are we really to believe that none of these people knew about this guy's true nature? So what people have been speculating on is that Morrissey, who's always been seen as a very outspoken, controversial figure, may have had some kind of inside knowledge very early on, 1986, many, many years before Savile was exposed, of what this guy was all about. The official story of how the lyrics to The Smiths' Panic came about have it that Morrissey and Johnny Marr of The Smiths were listening to this Radio 1 broadcast in April of 1986, where the news had given details of the Chernobyl nuclear reactor disaster in Russia that happened that year. You know, this very grave piece of terrible news. And they say that directly coming out of the news, you had the Radio 1 disc jockey Steve Wright, who started to play Wham's I'm Your Man, this happy, fluffy record. And, you know, he got into DJ mode and he was like, hey, this Radio 1 is fantastic. Here's Wham, I'm Your Man. And they were objecting to the fact that he was being so lighthearted and trivial about this terrible piece of news that had just happened. So we're told that they penned this song Panic, and it was largely in protest at Steve Wright. So when you get the refrain of the song, hang the DJ, hang the DJ, it's supposed to be them in reference to Steve Wright. I wonder if that's the case, though, because in this song, they say, burn down the disco, hang the blessed DJ. Steve Wright was a radio DJ, or more a broadcaster than a DJ, more so than any kind of club DJ, whereas Jimmy Savile started his career as a nightclub DJ in discotheques. So we have the lyric, burn down the disco. There's a few other connections that I've noticed. Many researchers are of the belief that Jimmy Savile dyed his hair peroxide blonde in this very striking, iconic look that he rocked for the rest of his days, in homage to Myra Hindley, who was one of the Moors murderers. Myra Hindley and Ian Brady killed a bunch of children and buried their bodies on Saddleworth Moor, close to Manchester, in the 1960s. Absolutely horrific stuff. They became notorious public figures in the 60s. Jimmy Savile befriended Myra Hindley and is said to have been infatuated with her to the point that he dyed his hair so that he looked a lot like her in her publicity photos. And Savile travelled around all over the place. He certainly worked for a time in Manchester, very close to where the Moors murders took place. The Leeds connection is interesting because Savile came from Leeds, and we had a spate of horrific rapes and killings in the UK in the 1970s going into the very early 80s by this character known as the Yorkshire Ripper, this guy Peter Sutcliffe. One of the Yorkshire Ripper's victims' bodies was discovered in Leeds, very close to Roundhay Park, where Jimmy Savile had an apartment. And Savile became close personal friends with Peter Sutcliffe, the Yorkshire Ripper, visiting him in jail many times and being photographed with him. And he introduced the boxer Frank Bruno to Peter Sutcliffe as well, and they became friends. This is all pretty worrying stuff. So, you know, there's some Savile connections with the Yorkshire Ripper there. And then it goes back into Morrissey and the Smiths, because Morrissey also seems to have been infatuated with the Moors murders of Myra Hindley and Ian Brady, because he published a song, he composed a song called Suffer the Little Children. And the lyrics to it are pretty harsh, where he's naming some of these poor kids that were murdered by this satanic couple. And let me just get the lyrics here. Over to the moor, take me to the moor, dig a shallow grave, and I'll lay me down. Leslie Ann, one of the victims, with your pretty white beads. Oh, John, you'll never be a man, and you'll never see your home again. Oh, Manchester, so much to answer for. You know, this is a very dark, very unsettling song that Morrissey put out. So there is a suspicion among some people that Morrissey moved in such circles as to have inside knowledge of what Jimmy Savile was all about, and he was expressing it in this song. Some think by way of warning people in a very coded, covert way, because he couldn't come right out and say it. But then you get counterclaims from certain people who will say, well, there's more to know about Morrissey than meets the eye. And some people seem to think that he may be involved in some sort of pedophilic activity himself. This is all alleged, of course. Nothing's been verified or validated. But people point to this song of Morrissey's called... now, what is it called? Just give me a second to find the lyrics, because I've got them here. I don't know if you've got any reaction to that so far, Tim, while I look for these lyrics.
Well, I mean, obviously, Savile was exposed posthumously, right?
Yes.
So after he was dead, he was safe to, expose. Of course, we're led to believe that nothing was above Savile. It was just Savile. But, of course, his connections to, you know, to Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, to the royal family, to many, the premier musical acts. I think there's photographs of him hanging out with the Beatles. Prince Charles, these things. And it's interesting, the point that he would, again, don the disguise of philanthropy to carry out his crimes, because that seems to be a modus operandi of a lot of the elites, as to,
Well, it does. I mean, David Rockefeller was described as a philanthropist.
Yes.
And so's Bill Gates.
Bill Gates, as they, conspired to depopulate and poison the general population, to dumb everyone down. Obviously the whole tactic of opening up foundations, and this is a whole way that you can carry out high-level criminality and fraud, is through these various foundations. Recently, of course, fairly recently, we've had the exposure of the Clinton Foundation, and some of the things it's facilitated or been involved in. Of course, we're not seeing any real criminal prosecutions, despite the large amount of evidence that, at the very least, it was a money laundering operation. But you do get a lot of evidence of dark things occurring with human trafficking and these things, not just sort of resource extraction stealing money. These things, directing aid money to profiting off it. I think Hillary's brother got control of some mines down in Haiti, and you've had construction of, like, for what I heard, is like luxury resort facilities in Haiti, some parts of Haiti, with a lot of this relief money. So,
So the song that I was thinking of by the Smiths is called Handsome Devil. And we can look at some lyrics, which are a little bit unsettling. He says, a boy in the bush is worth two in the hand. I think I can help you get through your exams. Okay, so he appears to be addressing a schoolboy here. He says, and you skip, but you deserve it. You deserve it, deserve it. And when we're in your scholarly room, who will swallow whom? When we're in your scholarly room, who will swallow whom? There's more to life than books, you know, but not much more. Oh, you handsome devil. So, don't know about you, but that's raised a few alarm bells for me. I've always actually rather liked Morrissey. I enjoyed the music of the Smiths. I liked a lot of his solo stuff. And I've always liked the fact that he has been outspoken and controversial, and he makes the headlines. In particular, he's been a very outspoken vegetarian. The Smiths put out the album Meat is Murder back in 1985, and that song stands as a really damning kind of manifesto for vegetarianism and exposing the horrors of what goes on in slaughterhouses. So I always rather liked him for that. but there are some disturbing elements to his persona. He was due to go on tour with Cliff Richard the other year, which seems a very unlikely music pairing. That's a bit like Tupac going on tour with Liberace. Yes. Morrissey and Cliff Richard is not a pairing that I would automatically think of. That got cancelled in the end when it was announced that Morrissey had a form of cancer, interestingly, and Cliff Richard was undergoing a scandal of his own involving allegations of child abuse at this particular event where he was present with the pastor Billy Graham. So Cliff Richard's been embroiled in that whole stuff. So is there more to know about Morrissey and the Smiths? There probably is. And it's just an interesting one for people to consider, I think, particularly in light of the lyrics of that song. One other possibility, if you don't accept that Morrissey was exposing stuff that he knew about Savile but couldn't come right out and say at that time, is that he was in some way tapping subconsciously into some kind of collective consciousness, I guess. This is something you hear about from time to time. Thomas Sheridan did a presentation on this phenomena at AV9, the Alternative View 9 conference in May over here in the UK. He was talking about 9/11 and all these apparent examples of predictive programming in popular culture, mm-hmm. where movies and music videos and stuff seemed to foreshadow elements of what was going to happen in September 2001 in the days and decades prior to it. And his view is that it's not foreknowledge on the parts of these musicians and these filmmakers that this is going to happen, but they're somehow intuiting it and channeling it through getting in touch with spirit guides, I guess. This is something you hear about artistic types, whether they're music makers or painters or sculptors or writers. They seem to be able to channel ideas and expressions of consciousness into their work by, you know, getting in touch with entities maybe or other forms of consciousness. This is where the word music comes from, the idea of the muses. The muses were these kind of entities, these non-human entities that I think Greek and Roman society used to speak of. And people were able to get into altered forms of consciousness and make contact with these entities and intuit information from them. So people have speculated that maybe Morrissey was unknowingly tapping into the public consciousness of 2012 when the people of Britain found out about Savile, and the sentiment indeed would have been hang the DJ, you know, get this guy that's been slipping down these side streets of Leeds. So I don't know, people can make of that one what they will, but this is something that is suggested for why certain songwriters bring things into their lyrics. You hear it with the likes of Led Zeppelin and the song Stairway to Heaven. I think Robert Plant and Jimmy Page have actually spoken about how they channeled stuff into the lyrics of that song, and they're not entirely sure where it came from. I think Elton John and David Bowie and many others have spoken of this process in their songwriting, bringing it out of the ether and putting it into these songs. So maybe that's a thing. Maybe that really happens.
Yeah, a sort of a sixth sense, you could say. So exposing these things,
That kind of idea.
Well, I mean, in the book you mentioned that guy who claimed that the music, when it was more analog, was actually, there were some satanic incantations put into the music?
Tim, just hold on one second, mate.
Okay. Yeah, I was saying, well, in this case, you have the sort of the sixth sense being serving the some sort of revelatory process. But in the book, you also cover how music can be. You had the person who claimed that, you know, even when music was even analog, that certain, I guess, incantations, satanic incantations, were put into the music to have its effect when you listen to it. And then you ponder, you know, with, of course, the advent of digital technology and these things, what's being done to the subconscious when we listen to these music. Obviously, we have lyrics, the reprises and these things. People start singing a song, like, look at the, look at something like the song Sympathy for the Devil, where you have the, you know, Satanist Mick Jagger, where he comes out and sings this very popular song, and the whole, you know, people are singing to it, and here's the devil. And there's an element of revelation to it, because you can say that he's just saying, you know, the influence of the devil and throughout human history and human, you know, throughout human history. But nevertheless, it's the devil coming out. He's being revealed for his influence throughout history, and you have people singing along to it. Well, what's the effect of that over the long haul, listening to these songs, singing the reprises? We all know that with music, that this, the tempo and the beat will have an effect on how one behaves. Who was the guy back in, he said I forget the person's name in the book, how he said...
Yeah, John Todd Collins.
John Todd Collins, yeah.
So he was known as John Todd, but he also seems to have been known as Lance Collins, and he comes from the Collins family, which is one of these important bloodline families. And there's another example. You know, this guy comes out of one of these important bloodlines, mm-hmm. and he's placed to work in the music industry in one of these high positions with various record labels and Zodiac Productions, one of these distribution companies. And there he is, presiding over all these acts and all these bands in one of these influential positions. It's just another example of how all this gets done. And the thing about songwriters just intuiting this stuff out of the ether, I'm sure it happens unknowingly in many cases. And if you asked many of these musicians where they get these songs from, they wouldn't be able to tell you. Mm-hmm. Or they might think that it came to them one night in a dream, or they were in a shopping mall one day and they saw a sign or something that just registered with them, whereas in fact it's come from somewhere else. They maybe don't even understand the process that's taken place themselves. But, you know, the record industry is so demonic at its corporate level, it turns out. And there's all kinds of occult practices that go on and ritualistic behaviors that who knows what capacity there is to be in touch with entities and other forms of consciousness. You know, I think demonic possession is a very real thing. We hear of so many musicians who change persona when they get up on stage and they even admit to it. You know, they say it feels as if something has taken them over. There's many famous quotes along those lines. And I think this is all very real stuff which happens in these industries.
Oh, yeah. You see, I mean, you have examples of, you know, Britney Spears supposedly breaking out of her programming, shaving her head.
Yeah.
And she comes, of course, comes out of the Disney stables. And same thing with, Lady Gaga, Katy Perry, from all accounts... was very different before she, it wasn't just changing because you're famous, but you're talking about a whole persona changes.
Yeah. And even guys like Ozzy Osbourne back in the day said, it feels as if I've been taken over by something. I hope it's not who I think it is, making comments like that. So it's been going on forever.
Yeah. And it's, this goes back to sort of, I guess you make it sort of a Faustian bargain or a pact with the devil. These things, and obviously, when you decide to pursue a career like that, it just goes like we mentioned earlier, how people longing to be famous, to be a celebrity, that itself is sort of a satanic, desire, because it just simply isn't something that that's natural or normal. How we relate to one another, how people relate, because that whole celebrity culture is plastic and fake. It's not real. I mean,
you're starting out with a satanic mindset, which is all about me, me, me. What do I want? What suits me? So you're kind of rife for manipulation by these industries if you start out with that viewpoint. I want to be famous and I don't care who I have to trample on to get there. You know, I think that's how they select many of their key players. I certainly think that was the case with Jay-Z, who always showed himself to be so wildly ambitious, and he wanted to be rich and famous and influential at whatever cost. And they love people like that because you're already exhibiting a tenet of Satanism with that kind of mindset before they get you along to their fucked up eyes wide shut style parties and all the rest of it. You know,
so yeah,
that's a selection, an aspect of the selection process, I'm sure.
Yeah. The whole notion, just the idea then, the good life is just living a normal life. And, no one may not even be recognized to the extent that outside your immediate family or something, and people that's not going to satisfy you. You need a claim. You need to be on the stage. And that is satanic. You shall be like a god.
That's right. All right. So I've got another piece of correspondence here. I thought we could just move on to the next act. Somebody brought REM to my attention. So REM is a band that I've never really gone for. I don't know much about them. never really been my cup of tea. But this person picked up on some comments that I'd made in the book and which I've raised in other interviews concerning the Copeland family. Mm-hmm. So this was Miles Copeland, a big-time career CIA officer, legendary within intelligence circles. He had three sons who all went to work in the music industry: Miles Copeland Jr., Ian Copeland, and Stuart Copeland, best known as the drummer with the Police. And this family really had a stranglehold on the whole punk and new wave movement. They very much directed that whole genre and were responsible for the way it got established, and, you know, they oversaw many of the big bands that came out of those scenes. So this person said to me, as you may know, REM were signed to IRS and FBI booked their shows. This was a little in-joke from the Copeland family. Mm-hmm. They named all their companies after expressions of the government. So they had International Record Syndicate, IRS, and Frontier Booking International, FBI. Very funny joke. So this guy says, REM were very close to the Copeland brothers. They even opened for the Police at Shea Stadium in New York and at other dates. Then it struck me that this military intelligence connection no doubt explains singer Michael Stipe's infamous reluctance to talk about his father, who, quote, flew helicopters in Vietnam, end quote. I think that did come from Michael Stipe. There are obvious comparisons to be drawn with Jim Morrison, who used to state that his parents were dead in interviews. Like Morrison, Stipe is known for his socially conscious lyrics, which appear to be diametrically opposed to those one would assume his father held. So Orange Crush, for example, the REM song, is about the use of Agent Orange in Vietnam. And this person says Stipe himself may be an MKUltra victim. He grew up on military bases around the world. This is something we get time and time again. The stories that come out of Laurel Canyon, as told by Dave McGowan, are very well known now. The likes of Frank Zappa and John Phillips and, of course, Jim Morrison and all those musicians out of that scene. There are connections there into the military, and many of these musicians were army brats that grew up on military bases and were educated there. So here we have another one with Michael Stipe. REM become this very successful, prominent, influential band. And he doesn't really want to get into what his father did, although you can do a bit of digging and you can discover that he was yet another military guy. And this is another thing that we get so often: groups making songs that appear to show that they're on our side, and they appear to be rallying against the establishment and making out that they're not with all that stuff. They're on the side of the people. They're just like us. I used to fall for this trick, and when I would hear a band or a musician put out a song like this, I would fall, you know, drink the Kool-Aid and think, oh, well, you know, I've got them all wrong. Listen to how they're rallying against all this establishment stuff. But I've come to understand that it's another military-grade tactic, and I refer to it as the disarmament tactic in my book. It's where one of these controlled bands that are doing the bidding of those that tell them what to do deliberately put out material that causes people to let their guard down. So you do indeed think they're a voice for the people and that they're basically on our side. It goes back to the Yuri Bezmenov stuff, I suppose, mm-hmm. You know, false heroes and role models and all these covert tactics for making an enemy.
It's the same thing with you know, offering a reform politician, you know, offering reform, you know,
right
against the system, you know. It's a relief valve or something, or misdirection.
Right. And you can think of people like Russell Brand, who is as controlled as they come. He was Katy Perry's mind control handler, for fuck's sake. You know, and the symbolism in his work couldn't be more blatant if it bashed you around the head savagely with a baseball bat studded with nails, mm-hmm. screaming, "I am symbolism, I am symbolism." But still, a lot of people fell for Russell Brand's act when he appeared on these TV shows talking about we need a revolution of consciousness and we need to overthrow the political oligarchy and all this BS, which is all just calculated propaganda. And we had the same thing, in my view, with Jim Carrey when he came out on interviews saying, oh, I've discovered the true nature of what we're doing here, and it's amazing, it blows my mind, we're spirit souls undergoing these conscious experiences. And, you know, he's saying all the kind of stuff that makes you think he's become a truther, in inverted commas, and he's broken out of the matrix and he understands the true nature of this reality and all this stuff. But to me, it's just another expression of this dynamic of false heroes and role models, making you think they're on your side.
Yeah, and so you're going to, again, devote a lot of emotional energy, money, and time into following them, as opposed to sort of just to thinking these things out yourself. And also thinking that, also it sort of reestablishes some trust or faith in the system itself, that you believe that there's within the power structure there's an alternative, they're competing, you know, there's a check on the oligarchs, and they're going to represent your interest, and you know, maybe voting isn't a waste of time. You know,
right.
The system does work, broadly speaking, and so you're not going to, you know, look, you're not going to step outside the matrix, so to speak.
Exactly. So another piece of correspondence concerns another band, and we have another Miles Copeland connection here. So this is to do with The Fall, you know, the punk band The Fall, mm-hmm. coming out of Manchester in 1976. Their singer, their founding member, Marquis Smith, died in January this year, age 60. But anyway, this person says, they're always a fan of The Fall, great cryptic lyrics full of visions of the future, massively influenced by the writer of Blade Runner, Philip K. Dick. Now, this is where it gets interesting. Who gave them their first break? Miles Copeland, no less. This is Miles Copeland Jr., the record executive coming out of that CIA family. Mm-hmm. This person says The Fall was signed to one of his offshoot labels. Marquis Smith evidently spoke very highly of Miles Copeland in interviews. He booked The Fall, this is Copeland, to support The Clash in their infamous series of gigs in 1981. Marquis Smith's ex-wife, Brix Smith, named after Brixton in London, and she was born Laura Elise Salinger, so she was Jewish and from America, but she married Marquis Smith and moved over to the UK. Her mother was an executive for the CBS TV network, and this person says Brix Smith met Marquis Smith at a Chicago concert in April 1983 and moved to his native United Kingdom, where they settled in Manchester and married in July of that year. That's fast work. Mm-hmm. What is that? 3 months from meeting to getting married. So, yeah, quick work there, Mark. Fall's ex-bass player Steve Hanley claims in his autobiography that Marquis Smith had a CIA contact, and he wonders if it was Miles Copeland. Marquis Smith also predicted the Manchester Arndale bombings, this person says, and Terry Waite's kidnapping. Terry Waite was a special envoy to the Archbishop of Canterbury, and he was reportedly kidnapped by Beirut terrorists in 1987, I think it was, and held in captivity in Lebanon till 1991, according to the official story. So Marquis Smith apparently predicted that it was going to happen. This person also says that The Fall put out 33 albums and had 66 members across its history. And then looking some further into Brix Smith, Marquis Smith's wife, there's this story reported by a newspaper where she was in Disney World on a romantic break with the violinist Nigel Kennedy. So this is another industry relationship. Nigel Kennedy is a quite well-known classical music player that always rocked a punkish kind of anti-establishment look, so he's probably just another Lifetime actor. So she's on this break with him at Disney World, and this newspaper report says Brix Smith was looking around for some consolation because her relationship wasn't going so well when one of the amusement park's Mickey Mouses started flirting with her. She says, "I was so unhappy and depressed and on Prozac, here we go, and miserable. I was in such a bad way that Mickey Mouse seemed like a good option, but only if he kept his head on. This alerted my attention because I've done research into trauma-based mind control, mm-hmm. and particularly Monarch mind control programming, an aspect of MKUltra, which ties right back into Disney. And it's known in some circles as Mickey Mouse programming. So Mickey Mouse, with his distinctive headpiece with those protruding ears, is an emblem or a motif for a particular style of mind control programming. So Michael Jackson is rumored to have been a part of this program, and this brings in the whole Mickey Mouse Club coming out of Disney, mm-hmm. where the likes of Britney Spears, Christina Aguilera, Justin Timberlake, and Miley Cyrus got their first big break. And you also have the electronic dance music artist coming out of Canada known as Deadmau5, real name Joel Zimmerman, whose little party piece is to appear behind the decks doing entire DJ sets with a bloody great Mickey Mouse head on. So is it just coincidence that Brick Smith talks about wanting to get it on with Mickey Mouse, but only if he wears his distinctive head? Or is that a little knowing nod to this aspect of mind control programming? It's more a question than a statement, but it's another one that is worth people considering, I would say.
Yeah, and also the whole Mickey Mouse Club, and sort of this blurring of the distinction between human and animal is sort of a, you can almost see it as sort of a degradation agenda there, going there. And obviously we see it now in a lot of music videos. You also mentioned, the whole idea of these celebrities serving, you mentioned how she mentioned being on Prozac, and a lot of them, these celebrities with their addiction to drugs over the, with prescription drugs, sort of promotes a pharmacological agenda that we see kind of suggested, Aldous Huxley wrote about in Brave New World, everyone's on their summer pill and their... unhappiness. Well, here I am. I'm on Prozac, and that you see that in all types of TV shows and movies. It becomes normal, and now we have a situation. I think where 25% of the adult population here in the United States is on some drug.
Yeah,
and it normalizes these things.
It's kind of implying that your favorite celeb is on Prozac, so you should be too. It's fine, Everyone's doing it.
Yeah, and they seem to be functioning okay, so it's okay.
If beating up cars with umbrellas and running into oncoming traffic is good behavior, I don't know.
One thing you also mentioned in the book is this: how a celebrity will be marketed, put up there, served out on a plate for us. They'll develop a certain amount of credibility through their art form, but then be used to promote a certain agendas, right? I mean, they're just...
Yeah. I mean, the normalization of Prozac and other pharmaceutical drugs is one aspect of that. Mm-hmm. And then you see so many celebrities suddenly supporting LGBT rights or getting in on the transgender movement. And there are many female artists out of the UK that are linked to that scene now. So Kim Wilde, who was a big female solo artist in the 80s, in more recent years has been nailing her colors to the whole LGBT mast, and Samantha Fox the same way, who was a Page 3 topless model turned pop star in the 80s. And Cyndi Lauper, I think, is big on that LGBT scene, and Madonna has endorsed it as well. So it's just many examples of what these artists are used for. And we've got even grime artists like Skepta out of the UK now seemingly endorsing the transgender agenda by saying that he's gender fluid and he wears women's clothing and it's cool because everything's non-binary now. Mm-hmm. It's all so obvious. It's all agendas, and they just use these celebrities to normalize these things. And kids who look up to somebody like Skepta are going to think, if he thinks it's okay, then I guess it must be. And then there's the whole transhumanism thing as well. You've got artists like will.i.am out of the Black Eyed Peas that always appears as a cyborg and a robot. And it's making people that follow his music think, technology is the future. Isn't it great? Artificial intelligence is obviously a really good thing because will.i.am is telling us it is. So it's nothing to be afraid of. You see these agendas all over the place, and it just becomes so freaking obvious, to be honest, once you've seen it a few times. So another thing that was brought to my attention concerned Fleetwood Mac's Danny Kirwan, I think is how you say it. So somebody emailed me about this guy, and he said, this guy has been institutionalized for the last 40 plus years after being fired from the group, Fleetwood Mac. He and Peter Green both lost it after an incident in Munich when they were both given acid at a very wealthy commune that they'd been lured to. This reminds me of Timothy Leary and the acid experiments he used to do at Millbrook Mansions, which was this country estate that was bequeathed to him by the Hitchcock Mellon wealthy banking family.
Another banking family, yeah.
Exactly. I mean, what else would you use a country mansion for other than LSD experimentation, right? It's obvious. So that brings to mind that whole scenario. So apparently this guy from Fleetwood Mac was involved in LSD experiments at this wealthy commune, you know. And so this person that emailed me says, a friend told me he'd met Danny in the 90s and he said that he'd been experimented on at an American army base. Here we go again, a link into mind control, programming and the military. No one believed him, and by then he was living in a homeless hostel. Peter Green, this person says, has been hearing voices since then, and of course the band went on to achieve megastardom in the US. When he told me this story, it brought to mind one which I included in my last book, and it concerned members of the Detroit 1960s proto-punk group known as MC5, Motor City 5. And I relayed a story in there of Wayne Kramer and Michael Davis of this group, who were inmates at the Federal Medicine Center in Lexington, Kentucky.
Oh, yeah.
Known initially, this place was known colloquially as the United States Narcotic Farm. I mean, where else would you find a couple of rockers than in one of these places, right? Although it's described as a federal prison for inmates requiring medical or mental health care, it's also one of the key hospitals involved in the CIA's MKUltra drug experimentation program. So a couple of members of MC5 pop up in this place. Why am I getting flashbacks of the hospital in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest here with Jack Nicholson? And it turns out that William Burroughs, the beat poet, who so influenced the counterculture scene of the 60s and the later punk and new wave scene, the likes of William Burroughs and Allen Ginsberg and all these beat poets were real cultural heroes of those scenes, for some reason, also attended the same institution. You know, this narcotic farm. Just deviating slightly from the music industry to the Hollywood film industry here, we have a connection going back into MKUltra. You know, when I read that paragraph about that place being one of the key hospitals that was used in the MKUltra mind control program, I was reminded of an email that I got from somebody regarding Nicole Kidman's father, the famous Hollywood actress Nicole Kidman, who was put together with Tom Cruise for many years. Tom Cruise has always struck me as being a likely candidate for mind control programming through some of his strange behaviors. But Nicole Kidman's father was Dr. Anthony Kidman. This person that emailed me said he was literally connected to MKUltra, publishing papers with known MKUltra doctors and working at St. Elizabeth's Hospital in Washington, D.C., where Bear Elsley, L. Ron Hubbard and Ezra Pound, Eustace Mullins' mentor, were all mental patients at some time. He says Nicole Kidman's father was a clinical psychologist and a member of the Ninth Circle satanic cult in Sydney, Australia. Dr. Anthony Kidman immediately fled to Singapore after he'd been accused of rape, torture and murders of several children. He died in Singapore September 12, 2014, this person says, a month after those accusations. His death was not due to natural causes, although Wikipedia would tell you he had a heart attack. So here we have another connection between MKUltra, the CIA, and a famous celebrity. In this case, the Hollywood actress Nicole Kidman, whose career, of course, went stratospheric, as so many of them do. Isn't that all interesting stuff?
Yeah, again, you're tying in MKUltra into Hollywood, and of course, a lot of these actresses and actors, strong indications that they are, lack of a better term, mind controlled. They're trauma-based mind controlled, and that's, you know, why we see them often going into these rehab centers like Wonderland and these things, and which some people say is another form of reprogramming or mind control. Some people have suggested that even the whole agent system is a sort of a cover for a handling system. The agents, the talent agencies handle these people in a way. Of course, given her role in Eyes Wide Shut, which some people see as sort of a revelatory film,
about
the elite, and why would she be picked, and you know, the whole Scientology angle there, I think, because Stanley Kubrick's daughter, I think, was into Scientology and had been estranged from him or something, and I think some people say it was his attempt to reconnect with her. But again, we get into this, all these
well, it's all starting to come together.
You have all these actors,
you come to realize that it's all coming full circle, and the connections and the spin-offs and the tentacles go off in all kinds of different directions, but it's all becoming so clear now. All these seemingly disparate random standalone things from throughout history and from throughout these different facets of popular culture. It's all starting to come together and it's all starting to make some sense now, and you realize it's not random at all, none of it. So this same person that had emailed me about that guy from Fleetwood Mac went on to talk about Eric Clapton.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so he says, one guy, who I shouldn't name, he says, was in a band with Eric Clapton in the 60s, and we were talking about blues and stuff and its associations with Satanism. Mm-hmm. We've got that whole legend of Robert Johnson mm-hmm. meeting the devil at the crossroads back in the day and selling his soul for fame and fortune. That seems to be a variation on this Faustian bargain idea that you see recurring throughout the music industry throughout the decades. This person, the emailer says, told me that Clapton had taken part in a ritual where a cat was sacrificed. His goal was to achieve the absolute number one position as a guitarist in the business. The sacrifice took place and the black cat was slaughtered. My friend pointed out shortly thereafter what happened to Clapton's direct rivals at the time. Hendrix died, Peter Green lost his mind, and Mick Taylor became an alcoholic heroin addict. Clapton grabbed the crown as well as his best friend's wife. That would be Patty Boyd, I guess,
yeah.
who we mentioned earlier, who was the wife of George Harrison for a time as well. And now, what's this story about the helicopter crash? I think I've got it here. Yeah, more on Eric Clapton, which comes from my book, Musical Truth Volume 1. I mentioned this. A story that devastated the public in 1991 was the tragic death of Eric Clapton's four-year-old son, Connor, who plunged from the open window of Clapton's 53rd floor apartment in Manhattan. Clapton had fathered Connor with Italian model Lori Del Santo while he was still married to Patty Boyd, who'd previously been the first wife of George Harrison. Connor's death came during an unlucky period for Clapton. 7 months earlier, fellow musician Stevie Ray Vaughan, plus Clapton's manager, agent, bodyguard, assistant tour manager, and a pilot, had all been killed in a helicopter crash after leaving a gig in Wisconsin. Clapton dedicated the song Tears in Heaven to the memory of Connor. Inevitably, however, rumors have persisted that there may have been foul play involved in the boy's fall. Did seem very suspicious. We've got this whole thing about ritual sacrifice, a blood sacrifice of a close family member or a close personal friend, which many of these celebrities are required to submit or to undergo in exchange for the fame and fortune that's gifted to them. So, of course, many people think that the fall of this poor boy may be connected with Clapton's success in some way. Just a rumor, of course, just a theory, unproven, but it's one that constantly crops up. And then you've got this horrific helicopter crash where all these people die. So could be some more to that. And you've got this strange story of Eric Clapton apparently, reportedly, taking part in this ritual where a cat was sacrificed. I'm reminded of early stories of Aleister Crowley from that, where Crowley apparently, when he was first becoming adept at occultism, decided to sacrifice a cat because he wanted to test out this theory that it had nine lives. So he, you know, strangled it and burnt it and drowned it and all these different kind of things to see if it would survive. Fairly horrible story,
yeah.
But that's one that sprang to mind. And also there's this story of Sid Vicious. I forget who it was, but it was a close personal friend of Sid Vicious in a documentary was recounting this time that he was in a flat with Sid during his early years with the Sex Pistols, or early days, I should say, because he was only in the band for about a year. And this person said that Sid Vicious had this cat. I think it was a stray cat that he got in his flat, and he decided to hang the cat right in front of him, put a rope around the cat's neck, hung it. The cat was traumatized and terrified, and it shat itself and pissed on the floor. And this friend of Sid Vicious just sat there horrified at what was going on, but evidently didn't lift a hand to try and stop it. So just another story that sprang to mind. You know, it's a very strange one that Eric Clapton would be involved in some kind of ritual involving the slaughter of a cat. So Clapton's not really come up in many stories before, but there's a few for you.
Yeah, and you had that whole, I guess, that meme or Eric Clapton is God that was people would write on walls.
It's interesting yeah. that if you're a blues musician or an aspiring blues musician, you're kind of entrained to think of Eric Clapton as a blues guitarist god.
Mm-hmm.
and also Jimmy Page. Mm-hmm. These are two guys that you kind of have to revere. So you hear all these artists in interviews, oh yeah, Eric Clapton's my hero, Jimmy Page, best guitar player ever. And it's a similar kind of thing to hip hop. If you want to be a hip hop DJ or a turntablist or a rapper, it's kind of expected of you to give it up for Kool Herc, Afrika Bambaataa, and Grandmaster Flash. I know this because, you know, coming up as a hip hop DJ myself, you kind of have to embrace Bambaataa as a demigod, as a leading icon of that scene. And if you don't call him out and say that he's an inspiration, people don't tend to take you seriously in that field. It's interesting that you've got these Pied Pipers that you kind of are expected to revere in these circles, and Clapton would be one.
And it's very hard, again, goes back to what you were saying earlier, when you do revere these people as either, you know, role models or icons or great artists that have inspired you, and huge part of your life, identifying with them, it's very hard to accept that they are indeed sort of satanic Pied Pipers that are leading you and your entire generation to destruction.
Nobody wants to hear that.
No one wants to hear that. No one wants to hear that they can be so buffaloed or fooled and taken into this, because they take it as, you know, I guess an insult to their own intelligence or their dignity as human being, their free will. But they're being, you know, again, it's hard to see that some of these weird things have been going on behind the scenes in the music industry and entertainment in general. But again, we do get glimpses of it, whether it's strange deaths and Satanism, actresses being, being decapitated in car accidents, and their acolytes of Anton LaVey and these things. Why would these, why is it so widespread if it's not important? It doesn't reveal some the true nature about the industry itself and what it's seeking to do.
Right.
Obviously, with mass communication and technology, the power of music and entertainment is undeniable. And do you really think that those in power are not going to use it exercise and maintain control over society in general, when historically it's always been used that way? The arts have always been somewhat weaponized, and technology itself just affords them a greater opportunity. Look at today's, you alluded to people's addiction to technology and the internet and these things, and how people are so wired in now. We're bathed in electromagnetic radiation now with Wi-Fi this, Wi-Fi that. People's attention spans have been shortened. They have to be constantly entertained and stimulated, and it's all
sorry,
done.
What were you talking about again? That was a bad joke.
Yeah. Sorry, I was checking my email.
Sorry. Carry on.
Checking Twitter or checking Instagram. Yeah. And I see it. I mean, especially in succeeding generations, I think I've heard you talk in other interviews that people from when younger people aren't going to know anything else other than complete, full monitoring, it's self-driving cars or computer chips and, chips in their forearms they can go buy.
We're the last generation that recalls Sailor Times, you and I and every one of our age group. That's it.
Yeah. And again, it's one of these things where it's this cult of technology, which with people like Elon Musk and Bill Gates sort of they're put out there to promote the cult of technology and these things, And the whole, I guess satanic thing is largely salvation through technology, right? I mean, that's the transhumanist thing, right? You can become a god because you can upload your consciousness to the mothership and then download it into some sort of cyborg and live forever, which strange enough, they actually have that vision, right? I mean, that's...
Yeah. I mean, how has humanity coped these last few thousand millennia? I mean, how have we coped without this technology? It's unbelievable. Mm-hmm. But here we are now, anyway. So the aspect of technology brings us into the next piece that I wanted to raise. Mm-hmm. And, of course, there's connections back into the world of military intelligence. Why wouldn't there be? It's the music industry. Come on. How can it be any other way? So somebody else got in touch and they put me onto this story involving Blink 182, which is another group that I've not really paid attention to. But there's a story involving that group's Mark, what's his name? Hoppus. Mark Hoppus. Mainstream news story emerged just recently. Mark Hoppus had shared details of a rather novel plan he once hatched to capture Saddam Hussein. The bassist and singer of the punk veterans took to social media to reveal that he once advised a Navy admiral on the most effective way to capture the then president of Iraq and remove him from power. And he says this happened on an aircraft carrier in the Persian Gulf. I mean, where else would you expect a punk group bassist to be than on an aircraft carrier in the Persian Gulf, right? Where else would they be hanging out? And what else would they be doing with their time other than advising a Navy admiral on how best to capture the dictator of some overseas nation? I mean, it happens every day in punk groups, right? Normal. So apparently this guy's plan, this was his tweet. This is from the news report. At the time, Hussein was in hiding but continued releasing videotaped messages to his followers. And Mark Hoppus says, my idea was to have trucks with big speakers drive around blasting time code just out of the frequency range of human hearing, but within the dynamic range of the video camera's microphone. When Saddam released a tape, he would have inadvertently recorded the time code. Of course, this doesn't take into account the fact that there were Saddam Hussein doubles who were actors for the CIA creating these videos, but that's by the by, I suppose. He says he would have inadvertently recorded the time code. Using the time code, you could go back and forth and pinpoint a general radius from where the truck was. With that information, you start the search, he says. So, you know, a punk band assisting the intelligence community. And that put me in mind of another equally bizarre story that emerged in January of this year concerning the electronic dance music producer Moby. And he claimed that he'd been called on by the CIA to spy on the Russians in the wake of claims that they'd somehow manipulated the American election for Trump to win. So he said, oh, I got a phone call from the CIA one day and they said, would you do some espionage work for us? So presumably he was in between producing tracks and he said, yeah, I've got a couple of days free. I'll do a bit of spying work for you. You know, what else does a dance music producer do? And in my last book, I just mentioned in passing that Moby was born Richard Melville Hall on September 11th, interesting date, 1965. And he just happens to be a direct descendant of Herman Melville, who was the writer of the Moby Dick novel. And he hailed from a Freemasonic family. But it's just a coincidence that Moby just happened to become a high-profile electronic dance music producer. And, you know, one of his ancestors wrote Moby Dick and was a famous novelist from a Freemasonic family. And he gets phone calls from the CIA. Just a coincidence, nothing to worry about.
Yeah, it's again, it's one of the yet another example of how we're dealing with ties or concentric circles. You know, how the publishing industry, yeah. Entertainment, intelligence, corporate banking, it's all one system, and it's they're interlinked because they all affect one another. Obviously, if you're entertainment and music, it's going to be cultural control, and cultural control is a big part of maintaining financial and political control of the population in general. So, you know,
yeah. And if there's anyone at this point who's been listening and they still think that all these stories can just be explained away as random chance and just the way it goes, and there's no connections or patterns here at all, I think you're listening to the wrong podcast.
Yeah.
I think you need to go and get yourself a Friends box set, or go and watch The X Factor, or go out to McDonald's and cruise the mall and buy the latest iPhone or something like that, because there's nothing more I can tell you, really.
Yeah. It's James Bond character says, it happens once, you know, it's just an accident. It happens twice, it's a coincidence. Three times, you did an operation.
that was Goldfinger in the original novel. Yeah.
So
I've got one more for you, Tim,
if you want to
go there.
Go ahead.
Okay, so another piece of correspondence. And as I say, I get these daily now. So I've just selected a few that we could talk about here. And I've selected some bands that I think are going to make people's ears prick up and make them pay attention. This one concerns the group Genesis. So I got an email one day and somebody said, oh, I've always loved Genesis. Is there anything nefarious about them that I need to know? And by that point, nothing had really come across my radar. So I said, well, I don't think so. They seem to be fairly straightforward. And I think it was a couple of days later that I got an email from somebody else saying, I've got some stuff about Genesis that doesn't sit easy with me. So it's as if the universe was answering the question and was directing this stuff my way. Mm-hmm. And it was saying, don't be so friggin' naive. Of course, there's stuff to know about Genesis. Here you go. So this one person said, my favorite rock band was Genesis. I liked a lot of their early songs, especially when Peter Gabriel was in the band. They seem to have some deep Illuminati or ancient mythological meaning and references in their lyrics. Could it be that the band was conveying something of hidden meaning rather than just straightforward songs? Well, yes, I would say it is. And this person goes on to reference a song called The Fountain of Salmacis, I think it is, if I pronounce that correctly. Or Salmacis, Salmacis. And he says, when you do a Wikipedia search for the Fountain of Salmacis, it's a Greek mythological reference to child rape. And this person says, maybe the Fountain of Salmacis was a Hellenic sculpture in the town of Bodrum, Turkey. The album from which this song is taken was entitled Nursery Crime. And there's another song called Musical Box from the same album, which has some strong but vague references to sex with children, this person says. So then you dig a bit into some of the members of Genesis. Couldn't discover too much about Phil Collins, but Mike Rutherford certainly had a father, William Francis Henry Crawford Rutherford, bit of a mouthful, who was a Royal Navy captain, would you believe it? And then he became a manager in industry upon his retirement from the service. And then Peter Gabriel, you discover that his great-great-great-uncle, Sir Thomas Gabriel, note the sir, was a baronet, and he served as Lord Mayor of London from 1866 to 1877. So there's some major aristocratic bloodline establishment links going there to Peter Gabriel, who just happens to crop up two or three generations later as the frontman for a very influential rock group. Genesis emerged out of the Charterhouse Public School in Surrey, which is one of these establishment breeding grounds. It's a very elite public school along the lines of Eton and Sandhurst, where all these future politicians and military types and business leaders emerge from. And they were discovered, it turns out, by Jonathan King. Jonathan King was a pupil at Charterhouse Public School also. He was a few years older than the band. And when they were teenage boys, alarm bells, alarm bells, Jonathan King is said to have persuaded them to form a band, and he became their manager, and he got Genesis on the scene. Jonathan King was also employed by the BBC for some time, contemporary with Jimmy Savile, and long before the Savile revelations broke or any of the recent spate of them, Jonathan King was exposed as having been a paedophile with a predilection for young boys. He ran a discotheque, just as Jimmy Savile had, called the Walton Hop in Walton-on-Thames, Surrey. And this was a breeding ground for young boys. It was basically a place where paedophiles would go to pick up children and then take them away and have their wicked way with them. You know, Jonathan King presided over that discotheque. That's what it was. The manager of the Bay City Rollers, Tam Patton, was linked to that whole thing as well, as was Chris Denning, who was yet another DJ employed by the BBC. He was on Radio 1 for a number of years, and he was part of this paedophile ring with Jonathan King, it later emerged. And this is the guy, Jonathan King, who established Genesis and was their first manager and put him on the map. So that alone is cause for concern for me. And then when you factor in things like them calling an album Nursery Crime and including songs that seem to reference child pedophilia going back into history, we seem to have a few warning signs there as well. And this is the case with so many groups. Somebody else had messaged me and said, oh, my favorite group is Madness. Surely there's nothing to discover about them. Well, unfortunately, Madness's videos are absolutely laden with mind control imagery that hint at programming, you know, and you got the very name of the group, Madness, known as the Nutty Boys. Do we have some little hints at mind control going on there? Got to ask these questions.
Yeah.
And, you know,
and the fact
you might not like the answers, but you're either going to go there or you're not.
Yeah. Everywhere you look, whether it's the motion picture industry, music industry, entertainment, these, again, these, unfortunately, most people's idea of reality and the culture is formed by them. And going back, as technology has allowed for more centralized control of these things, at least distribution and mass, you know, influence, when you point out that so many figures that are involved in forming these bands, producing the music, making these movies are pedophiles, degenerates, and they're in charge of the entertainment fare that most people consume. And whether subconsciously or overtly, people are going to start to reflect the values and behavior of the people that produce the music, which is probably sort of the objective of the entertainment industry itself, is that people will start to embrace and reflect the values that are being promoted by, you know, by music, by movies and these things. And that's why these figures like Aleister Crowley, Jimmy Page, who reportedly follows, was a devotee of Aleister Crowley, and the fact that the lifestyles of some of these people, the rich and famous, of these celebrities, these debauched lifestyle, it's written about and publicized so much, is there to make people either envy them or to somehow imitate their behavior in one degree or another. And as a result, society is degraded. And once you get degraded, you become a slave to your passions and your appetites. You are indeed a slave to the system itself, which is empowered to provide those things which you so desire. And that itself is the ultimate corruption. And that's the satanic agenda right there. And you lay out that's all right. These cases, and I don't see how someone come to any conclusion, look at the industry itself as being benign or just, you know, being just entertainment and these things. And as you know, so many people will allow their children to take in this stuff, to imbibe it, and they'll wonder why, you know, as a few years go by, they don't recognize their children anymore. And we're right now ourselves, or I'm supposedly a Generation Xer, but we saw with the baby boomers how corrupted they became and how morally corrupted or compromised they became, and how their inability to sort of not control but raise their kids in a way to protect them from these cultural vampires that seem to dominate, you know, society now. And we see it now with, well, I think we're seeing the later stages with so much family breakup and confusion. We see it with, you know, gender fluidity, these things. Obviously, such confused states are going to be made all the more worse when you have societal breakdowns, you know, family breakup, destruction of community. And this all goes to this whole idea of globalism, an idea of breaking down of communities, so everyone is just sort of an atomized individual with no roots, whether be they ethnic, religious, or you know or even philosophical. And those type of people, which unfortunately probably constitute a larger majority of the general population, are perfect subjects for the New World Order, which might be the ultimate agenda here. So,
well, they really did a number on the baby boomer generation, mm-hmm. because they were just coming of age in the mid to late 1960s, mm-hmm. having been born at the tail end of the Second World War, and they had all that social experimentation done on them coming out of the counterculture era. They must have really hated that generation, and they must really hate millennials. Mm-hmm. You know, these kids that were born round about the turn of the century, 1999, 2000, just coming of age now. Look at what's been served up to them. Look at the straight garbage that mm-hmm. passes for music now. You know, I've not heard anything in the mainstream charts in the past 18 years, certainly, that I can imagine being played in 50 years and being hailed as a classic. You know, these nostalgic shows they do, I Love the 60s, and you have mm-hmm. people getting all misty-eyed and nostalgic about how great the decade was, and, oh, this band were fantastic, and do you remember this scene that we were a part of? You know, who's going to be doing that in even 20 years from now, going, oh, Nicki Minaj, she was great. Miley Cyrus, do you remember her? Justin Bieber was fantastic. Oh, DJ Khaled made great records. 2 Chainz, he was marvelous. Young Thug, oh, what a rapper. Can't see it happening myself. You know, the music is garbage.
Yeah.
They're getting all this mind control programming. They're being trained to embrace transgenderism, transhumanism, the smart grid, Internet of Things society, technology. Isn't it great? You know, just go out and party, kids. That's the message from all this music. Life is short and it's meaningless and it's pointless ultimately. So just get out and get wrecked, you know.
Yeah.
Take drugs, shag whoever you want. Get drunk and wake up in a gutter the following morning. It's great. That's what life's all about. And that's the message that's being dumped on the millennials. So they must merely really hate them as well.
Yeah, yeah.
So the other day, I heard the Beatles' Day Tripper. I think I keep getting all these synchronistic episodes where, you know, the Smiths was playing everywhere the other day, just in preface to that email that I got about the lyrics to the song Panic. And I was looking into some Paul McCartney research, and don't get me started on that because I'll be here for another several hours. But as part of this, I heard Day Tripper by the Beatles, and the lyric just leapt out at me where it goes, "It took me so long to find out, and I found out." And I think that could be my epitaph. Mm-hmm. It took me so long to find out, and I found out. So here I am, and so many other researchers, so many other people, and not even professional researchers, just regular folk of the type that email me daily, are piecing all this stuff together and coming to realize that they've had a massive number done on them, and they've spent their whole life being mind controlled, and they're all saying, "It took me so long to find out, but I found out." And you can come to find out if you want to, if you choose to. It's going to take a very heavy level of denial, just blocking it out and not wanting to hear it, or naivety, thinking the world is basically a nice place and everything's normal, but every now and again you just get one of these anomalies, but it's nothing to worry about, honest. Or it's going to take somebody with a career and an ulterior motive to protect. So somebody that has a salary and a pension plan that relies upon them towing the official line, not rocking the boat, and just going along to get along. You know, you've got to be in one of those positions, I feel, to not be able to accept now, in 2018, that something is desperately wrong with the corporate music industry. And these groups and these musicians are not who you thought they were, and these songs are not what you thought they were. And I'm not out, as I've stated many times, to piss on anyone's parade. I don't want to have to destroy people's perceptions of their heroes. I take no pleasure in that. I'm just presenting information that I've come across that I think people might find useful and might want to take on board for themselves to come up with their own conclusions concerning who these people are and what these institutions are being used for. You can reject it if you choose, but I'm just someone, along with others, that's putting this information out there, and you can do with it what you will. I think it's very important that people do have access to this information. You're not going to get it from the mainstream media. You're not going to get it from Wikipedia. You're only going to get it from radio shows like this and, you know, researchers such as myself and many others that offer it to you in the very best of spirits, the most well-meaning of spirits, you know, because I just want people to be able to make more informed decisions based on getting access to information. So that's why I do what I do, and that's why I'm going to continue doing it.
Excellent. Excellent. So that's Mark Devlin. He is the author of Musical Truth 2, and of course, Musical Truth. I guess where's the best place to get that book, Mark?
Well, you can get both of them from Amazon if you choose, but if people want to leave Amazon out of the picture and come direct to the author, authors always get a better deal when you cut, you know, that middleman out of the equation. So if people want to email me direct on markdevlinuk@gmail.com, and if they want to pay by PayPal, then I can post out signed copies of the books. And I can post those anywhere. You know, it doesn't just have to be in the UK. Mm-hmm. I post out to America all the time and all around the world. So just drop me an email to markdevlinuk@gmail.com and I can get a copy of the book off to you. There is a Kindle version of it. And very shortly, I'm planning to get into the studio and record audio versions of both books. It's something I've wanted to do for ages, but it's just been a case of finding the time to sit down and record it.
Yeah.
Which has been very difficult, but I hope to do that during August. So there should be audio book versions of them available soon for people that like to get their information that way, as I do.
Great. And you're still doing the Good Vibrations podcast?
Yeah, I've been neglecting it a bit recently just because, again, I've not had the time to put into it, but it does continue, and I've got plans towards the end of this year to step it up and get some more guests on. So you can get the Good Vibrations podcast on iTunes. It's also on my Spreaker account, so if you look for Mark Devlin Good Vibrations on Spreaker, it's there. Also, my Sound of Freedom Conscious Music podcast is from both those sources as well, and that is music with messages that is uplifting, that inspires, that is the antithesis of all this corporate mind control stuff, you know, real music by real musicians. Mm-hmm. So if people want to check out the archives to that, I'm up to 85 volumes on it, and they, you know, you can really get lost in that for days with some music that is really going to speak to you in a profound way, I would suggest.
Great. Listen, thanks a lot, Mark. I'll let you go. Enjoy the rest
of your
evening.
Yeah, thanks, Tim. Thanks for getting me on, man. I appreciate you inviting me onto the podcast, and you're doing lots of great work yourself, putting out some good information. So keep doing your thing as well, man.
Thank you, and good day then. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
All right, all the best.
So long.
Okay.